right, everyone. It's Monday, January 20th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes, producer. Today is Martin Luther King's birthday. My first floor fight in the New Hampshire legislature was for Martin Luther King's birthday in 1985. It would be. And I even have video of that. Isn't that amazing? And you know how I have – so my seatmate, Catherine O'Brien – you may remember Catherine O'Brien. I've got to bring him in because I can't just look at him and talk. Rick Newman is also joining us. Rick, are you on live? I want to make sure I can hear you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Good morning, whatever it is. So Rick Newman serves in the New Hampshire legislature with me. He's going to be part of our Rethink the Week. He's currently a lobbyist. But Catherine was my seatmate. And I told this story actually on Friday, but I got to retell it. And she calls me up, and I've been in the legislature maybe 4 weeks. You know, we started in January. And she calls me up, and she says, I need your help tomorrow. For what? For a floor fight. For what? For Martin Luther King's birthday. Me? I didn't even attend the hearing. And I said, there must be somebody else. She said, Arnie, it was killed in committee. And if you don't speak on the floor with me, I'll basically be alone. And I went, you'll be what? And I'm like, all right. Okay, so here I am, like, totally hysterical. I got Kirsten on my hip. My first floor fight, I'm wearing, like, you know, red tights and plaid skirt. Oh, my God, I look like I was 12. And my knees are knocking, and I think I probably was, like, ready to wet my pants. And I get up to talk about this, and it was really the most – I realized how important it was that I was actually finding my voice on this occasion, okay? Out of the 400 members in the New Hampshire legislature – how many votes did we get? Do you remember that, Rick?
I don't, 85, because I remember that bill came up several times.
For years. It's been coming. Yeah. So this was right after Congress had passed it. So this was now going to the state. So it was really literally within less than a year. And so we were one of the first states to bring it up. Out of the 400, we got 60 votes. 60 votes. I couldn't believe it. I was just like, wow, this is the legislature I just signed up for. But that was my first.
I could just a shout out to former representative and current assistant mayor James Splain of Portsmouth, Jim Splain. Mm-hmm. He was the first person to sponsor the Martin Luther King holiday. He was a state senator in 1979.
Wow.
And he was the first time that bill was introduced was by Jim Splain. And he had asked me to be a co-sponsor of it. Yeah. I was a freshman. I didn't know enough to get down to legislative services in time.
Yeah.
So I missed the opportunity to be the co-sponsor. But Jim was the first guy to introduce that bill.
1979. And here I was, my knees knocking in 1985 because, you know, and that was my first one. I should call Jim and we should, like, get together for dinner or something just so we can celebrate those firsts.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, Ken, you have just returned from the border. How was it?
I have. I just spent the better part of a week down in Brownsville, Texas, and Matamoros, Mexico, at the International Bridge, which is a port of entry for entry of those fleeing violence in Central America, and they come up to the U.S. border. We started a vigil on Sunday, January 12th was the first day, and we're going to witness until they stop the MPP policy. The MPP policy stands for, and it's just ridiculous that they named it this, Migrant Protection Policy. And instead
it's the opposite of protection.
It's the opposite of protection. It's really the Migrant Harm Policy. It's also known as the Remain in Mexico Policy. And what it does is when people come to the U.S. border and present themselves for asylum, ask to be granted asylum in the United States because they have a good faith belief that they're going to be subject to violence and persecution back in their home countries, they have an absolute right under U.S. law and international law to remain in the United States in order to wait for their asylum hearings.
Mm-hmm.
And it sometimes takes a pretty long time to get to the asylum hearings where they'll decide the merits.
The number that attend asylum hearings are, what is it, 98% or 99%? I mean, it's just an incredible number. They all.
Yeah, more than 99% are denied. Yeah. But at least they could wait in the United States until Donald Trump enacted this MPP policy, this Remain in Mexico policy, where people come to the border, present themselves, and the Border Patrol tells them, go back to the other side of the bridge and stay somewhere in Mexico until we call you for your hearing. And number one, it's illegal, not in conformance with the law. Number two, it's inhumane because folks have just come 600,000 miles, whatever it is, from Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador fleeing violence, horrible violence, and they come to our border seeking some kind of protection, and then they're sent back to just sort of live nowhere and wait, and they don't have any jobs, obviously. They don't have any income. They don't have any house
there's
there.
No adequate
there's
shelter.
No
exactly.
place to stay. There's no food, nothing for the kids. And so they have set up, with the help of a lot of nonprofit groups, locally mostly, a tent city. And the conditions in the tent city are wretched. They're little pup tents that, like, if you were going camping, mm-hmm. and they're one right after another, right on top of each other, mm-hmm. and sometimes, you know, tied to the same boulder to hold them down,
yeah.
The tents next to each other. Not very much of a corridor in between, and that's the only place kids have to play. And families of two parents and three kids or whatever it is live in one of these tents all squished up. And that's where they've been living. Some of them, I went over the bridge and yeah. talked to people, and they've been there for 6 months or 8 months living in this tent city, waiting for their opportunity to even talk to a judge mm-hmm. and make their presentation why they should be granted asylum. Now that there are so many vulnerable people there at the border in no man's land, mm-hmm. no person's land, waiting, the gangs and drug cartels right. know that there's sitting duck prey mm-hmm. there, and they come in at night. There's no electricity in the tent city, and they come in at night and they do whatever they want. They extort people, they kidnap people, they sell children into sex slavery. I talked to one man who was really chilling after seeing his aunt and uncle in Honduras murdered right in front of their children and seeing their dismembered bodies. And then going to the funeral in Honduras and seeing the people that were in charge of murdering these folks, he sees them at the funeral in the back there, sort of glaring at them.
The intimidation continues.
Yeah, and then he gets here, and he's in this one little tiny tent with his three children sleeping on the floor, and two of his little girls are raped in the tent city. 9 and 11-year-old girls are raped right there under his nose while he and his wife are sleeping. And so now he says he won't even go to sleep because he feels he has to watch over his children and keep his family protected. You see people carrying wood and bringing it back to – they chop it up, and that's how they make fires so that someone can cook. And the only thing they have to cook is food that's brought in by volunteers from Texas, from Brownsville. Mm-hmm. And every day this volunteer group goes back there with wagons. You can see like three or four – wagon loads yeah. of food being brought back there. That's what people eat on their little wood fires. There's water brought over 3 days a week. And when that's gone, people have no clean water. And so they
do what they do in the river.
Well,
you were down there. What is the timetable for the hearings? How many people are they processing? How quickly are they doing it? When you get a number, I want to know, what is your number? 1 million?
Well,
1,000? 600?
It's an interesting question, because another policy that the Trump administration imposed is called metering, and they only let a certain trickle of people even come in to ask for asylum, to initiate the process.
Right.
You basically have probably three hearings. The first one's the initial hearing where they give you court date and
yeah.
papers and supposedly explain the process. Of course, they explain the process to these folks in English, and they don't speak English. Yeah. So that's really helpful. And they don't always tell people that they have a right to a lawyer, but they do have a right to a lawyer, but they can't afford a lawyer because
right.
they don't have any money.
Yeah.
So then the second hearing is the actual scheduling of the trial, and the judge asks them if they've gotten a lawyer, and they say no. You still want more time to try? Yes. And so the judge schedules the hearing. Instead of scheduling it for February, you know,
yeah.
a few weeks away, he schedules it for April to give them more time, supposedly, to get a lawyer.
But then they have to go back to Mexico?
But they're not going to – yeah, of course, they go back to Mexico right after the hearing.
So every time they have these hearings, they have to go back to Mexico. All right.
Absolutely.
Well,
absolutely.
We'll have to go on quickly.
One other thing. The judge is not in the room. The judge is on videotape, on a video screen.
Oh, God.
Off in some office somewhere.
Yeah.
And the lawyer for DHS, Homeland Security, who's like the prosecutor, you can hear his or her voice, but you can't even see them on the video because all it's focused on the judge. So it's like being in Big Brother land and in a language they don't understand, with a legal process that they don't understand.
This is called justice, right?
And they're told
I just want to make sure I can spell this.
And I talked to a bunch of people across the border who said, you know, they tell me I have to bring more proof. The proof that I have is insufficient, but I don't know what I can get. I don't have any more proof.
Yeah.
However far away from my home.
All right. So we'll continue this conversation in more depth. Real quickly, because it is Martin Luther King's birthday, Dean Spiliotis has just showed up. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. And thank you, Dean, for hanging out with me last night.
Oh, that was a great event, Arnie.
From Principia and St. Olaf, we were educating them on the sort of the New Hampshire primary, how this primary was different from others, about just even how to sort of do the kind of analysis as you were explaining to them, how you're able to maintain your arms length approach. Really quickly, please forgive me, gentlemen, but because it is Martin Luther King's birthday, I wanted to read one paragraph from the letter from the Birmingham jail, just because I suddenly realized he gave me a title for who I am. And it goes this way. But though I was initially disappointed at being categorized as an extremist, as I continued to think about the matter, I gradually gained a measure of satisfaction from the label. Was not Jesus an extremist for love? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Was not Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Was not Paul an extremist for the Christian gospel? I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus. Was not Martin Luther King an extremist? I stand. I cannot do otherwise, so help me God. And John Bunyan, I will stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a butchery of my conscience. Ah, and Abraham Lincoln an extremist. This nation cannot survive half slave and half free. And Thomas Jefferson, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. So the question is not whether we will be extremists. Ah, but what kind of extremists will we be? Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or the extension of justice? In that dramatic scene on Calvary Hill, three men were crucified. We never forgot that all three were crucified for the same crime, the crime of extremism. Two were extremists for immorality and thus fell below their environment. The other, Jesus Christ, was an extremist for love, truth, and goodness, and thereby rose above his environment. Perhaps the South, the nation, and the world are in dire need of creative extremists. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Anyway, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. What an amazing week. But I guess we keep saying that because every week feels like a year. I'm going to start with the most recent exploding news. The New York Times has decided to do the royal punt. For the first time in their 160-year history, they have endorsed for president in the 2020 campaign, or the caucus or the primary, two people. I guess it's the year of the woman. Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar. So I'm going to start with my arms length, yes. Political science professor. Sorry, the target's on you.
It's okay. I
thought that elections were about making a choice. I thought that that was the whole point. And for 160 years until this year, they had made a choice. So why don't you read the tea leaves for me? What the H were they doing?
I think they were essentially acknowledging that there is a fundamental split in the Democratic Party. We've talked about it many times here between progressives and between, you know, we could use the word moderates or non-progressives or whatever phrase you want to use. But this is a very deep division in the party. It's a ways yet from being resolved. It potentially threatens unity around whoever the eventual nominee is. And so I think they figured rather than, you know, stir up an additional storm, this is a way to kind of play it safe and let the party figure it out in the course of the primary. But I think it is indicative of how deeply split the Democratic Party is on this issue of is the goal kind of a reasonable return to some sort of, quote, normalcy, or is the goal to in some way acknowledge that the system is so fundamentally broken that you need to go in a very different progressive direction with a set of big policy proposals. And this is a fissure that has been been building in the party for a number of years. We saw it in the 2016 election with Sanders and Clinton, and we're now
we've seen it for years.
Yeah, it's been around for years. But it feels like it's coming to a crescendo. Yeah, absolutely. So, well, the fact that we now have not one, there's always been a quote kind of progressive darling in most of the Democratic primaries. You know, there's always some candidate.
Yeah,
there's always been somebody.
Paul Wellstone,
right? Exactly, or even Bill Bradley, we can talk about Bradley. Right. So, and then Bernie Sanders. But now we have two people representing a significant portion of the Democratic electorate. And so we're at a different place. And you look at the progressive victory that Bernie had in New Hampshire in 2016. You know, we would not have likely have seen that 10 or 15 years ago. So it's a different time. And I think this is an acknowledgement of how challenging this is going to be for the party to resolve.
So, Rick, about a year and a half ago, I think it's even on C-SPAN, January 1st, 2019, where I was on, and they asked me about what was happening with the presidential primary because they knew that I'm from New Hampshire, so they could start that conversation in January of 2019. And I said, and I've been saying it now for over a year, I didn't want Bernie or Biden to run. I've said this for a year and a half. And part of my rationale was that I think the bench needed to be refreshed and that I thought they should sit on the sidelines as elder statesmen for the progressive wing and the more moderate wing. And where are Bernie and Biden? But number one and number two, they're very familiar. And then I look at what the New York Times did with Klobuchar and Warren, and I'm kind of smiling because in a lot of ways – it reflects a little bit of my statement about Bernie and Biden from a year and a half ago. But at the same time, it's suggesting, and I think this is what their point is a little bit, is that there are like many ways to God. There may be many paths to defeating Trump. The question isn't just about defeating Trump, but the direction of the country. So you can both women, I think, have the potential to defeat Trump is what I think they're sort of saying. But what you get with that defeat is very, very different. Rick?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like they've endorsed ranked choice voting.
Yeah.
I mean, they couldn't make a decision, but they're saying like you said, there are two paths, if you will, from the Democratic perspective to victory. If you're a progressive, we're suggesting
Warren,
and if you're more of a Biden-Clinton voter, we're suggesting Klobuchar. Interesting, you know, decision making on their part. I'm not sure. My first take is when I saw it, I felt like they were taking themselves out of being relevant in the debate. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're raising the issue. It's an interesting issue. We could have a little academic discussion about it. But the reality is they're not making a choice. In an election, you have to make a choice.
Exactly. As my father would say, poop or get off the pot.
And you know what? I like Klobuchar. I could like Warren. I could like Biden. There are several Democratic candidates, but I'm going to have to – I only get one vote here in New Hampshire. I'm going to have to make a choice.
Do you think there is any – I'm just curious. This is just purely hypothetical. But do you think there was anybody here want to answer any kind of self-interested calculus in this in the sense that conservatives often say that the New York Times is really the paper of record for Democrats and progressives and non-conservatives. So they don't want to upset part of their readership. That essentially, if they endorse the moderate candidate, all the progressives are going to start like, getting on Twitter and saying I'm going to cancel my subscription, et cetera.
So we've experienced people like this in politics. Did we used to refer to them as mugwumps? Right. People that would sit on the fence and go both ways. I mean, in the end, that's part of the problem. And it's so interesting, you guys. Fox News, a producer from Fox News called me up about a week ago. And she said to me, Arnie, I want three or four people to be on our set on election day in Manchester, okay, on the primary day. I said, really? And what are they for? I'm just getting curious. She wanted to talk to three undecided voters who would then ultimately have to go in and vote in the primary about why were they undecided? How are they processing? What was driving this indecision? So I said, you know, I've done Fox in the past. So I said, I'll try to figure out if I can get you some people. And then I got an email from a woman in Concord, Rick, who has had virtually every single presidential candidate at her house. You know who I'm talking about
in
Concord.
Yes, I do.
I mean, she's had everybody. And she just sent out an email inviting folks over to her house, I think sometime at the end of January. Mm-hmm. What for? Because we're undecided. And she wants to get all these people in the room who are undecided because never in her life has she been so confused about a choice as she is now. And she wanted to be in a room.
Is it a I'm ambivalent argument or an embarrassment of riches argument?
That'll be I won't know till I get there.
Because I hear from some people they're ambivalent, and I hear from others that they like a lot. They're excited about a number of candidates.
Well,
I've heard both, especially the latter, but I've also heard it be about the word electability, which to me is a misnomer, because on the one hand, people are worried that the progressives will not be electable because they're too left, but on the other hand, one could argue, and plenty of people do, that it's the middle-of-the-road people who are Republicans light that are unelectable. And it
depends on how you model terms.
Well,
right.
Or electability.
Who you think's gonna show up.
But I think that's what people are thinking about is who can win.
Well, I also think electability could also be code for male, but that's another thing. I'm just saying.
I'm not so sure about that. I don't agree with that.
Well, from New Hampshire, you don't, because we've changed that conversation.
Yeah, I think a lot of us are looking at – I think there are several female candidates who are very electable and – I think – you know what I think is going to come down to in New Hampshire because of everything you've just said is that it's kind of that Reagan quality. Who do I like? There are several people I can vote for, several people I can agree with, but who do I like? You know, remember the polls with Reagan and particularly his second term where virtually every issue – the American people said, we don't agree with him. And then they overwhelmingly reelected him. And people, when asked why, they said, well, because we kind of like him.
Yeah. It's going to be very, very interesting. And then real quickly, because we're going to go and grab Dave Schultz about impeachment, because we have to talk about that as well, because that starts tomorrow. But that is that Andrew Yang's wife also did something fascinating in the last 72 hours or last Thursday. She announced on CNN, she went on CNN and she talked about the fact that she was sexually assaulted by her OBGYN. And it was an incredibly powerful, an emotional and politically brilliant conversation. And the reason it was politically brilliant was that not only did she sort of open up a door for a lot of other women who can totally relate to the conversation, but then her husband was able to talk about women in a very different way than Bernie Sanders. So Bernie and Elizabeth are fighting about whether he actually said to her, you know, women can't become president, or whether he said, Elizabeth, you can't become president. And there was this whole shadoo about the female card. And then Andrew Yang, Dean Spiliotis, pulls out the female card, but from a very, very different context. And it goes through his wife's voice about the OBGYN. And then he gets to talk about male misogyny, something that, you know, Elizabeth Warren couldn't talk about as effectively. Amy Klobuchar couldn't. And I thought it was another example of a guy who shouldn't be even at 5%, who once again is showing that despite the fact that he's not Tom Steyer, he's not Michael Bloomberg, I think he has some amazing political skills. And a lot of the young people that we were with last night, they were in a room with him and they were blown away by him. So I'm kind of curious, when you said the likability, what would that mean for an Andrew Yang in the New Hampshire primary?
Well, we'll see. You know, I think he certainly, as you mentioned, he has some political skills. He's hung in there, I think, well beyond a point that anyone thought that he would still be on the debate, although he wasn't in the last debate stage. Nonetheless, he's done a pretty good job of clearing the thresholds for the debates. You know, I still consider him sort of a successful niche candidate. I don't know what would propel him into the top two or three. I guess anything's possible. I don't think it's likely. I think that the universal basic income proposal, while very appealing to some voters, and you certainly can make a case that it may appeal as well to some Trump voters who are in similar economic circumstances. He even has a reasonable explanation for why you would give that income to somebody who's very wealthy. Everybody gets the $1,000. It's not income means tested. All positive things for him. I'm not sure what would catapult him though up into being a legitimate threat to Sanders or Warren
to elaborate on what he means by a successful niche candidate, because I'm wondering what niche Yang fills. He's not moderate. He's not progressive. He fills the niche of someone who is not a politician, talks like a reasonable person, and thinks before he answers.
He has all the reasons why he's still still in the conversation. The universal basic income proposal is not a consensus proposal even within the Democratic Party. And I think that is a self – it's in my view, it's a self-limiting proposal on his candidacy. The Democratic Party is not going to go into the November election with a universal basic income proposal. They're
right,
just not.
Quickly, Rick,
and that's why he's self-limiting.
You want to round out that conversation?
Well, I agree with Dean on that. I think we learned that lesson in 1972. George McGovern offered a similar proposal and – look what happened. I mean, and that wasn't the only reason, but it was certainly part of it.
So you know what
but
I
so
think
did
he's
Nixon,
doing?
And so did Nixon offer that.
Well, so did Martin Luther King, by the way.
Yeah, but Nixon got elected.
Just if that was to
Nixon
bring
got
up.
Elected and reelected.
Yeah, yeah. So what I also think is fascinating is so I posted that he is the most Democratic. I think he's the most politically savvy of all the candidates. That doesn't mean he'll win. It doesn't mean I'm not endorsing him. But I think you have to understand he's got this innate genius because it really is about his survivability and his ability to his likability, as you point out. And his ability to sort of get people from many different camps to want to listen to him. So when I pointed that out on Facebook, everyone has said, so what position should he get? Should he be the head of labor? Should he be treasury? Should he be chief of staff? So what he also, I think, is doing is not only running for president, but running for a cabinet position.
Yeah, he wouldn't be the first person to do that if that's what he's doing.
I totally agree. All right, everyone. This is the end of the first half of Rethink the Week. A little labor history is next. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Professor David Schultz from Hamline University, political science as well as law.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1986. That was the first time Dr. Martin Luther King Day was observed as a national holiday. A powerful voice for civil rights, Dr. King was assassinated in 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee, while standing on the second floor of the Lorraine Motel. He was in Memphis standing up for the rights of black garbage collectors. Dr. King gave his life supporting those fighting for union recognition. Throughout his work as a civil rights leader, Dr. King spoke powerfully of the importance of unions. Addressing a group of Teamsters in 1967, he said, "Union recognition meant the real beginning. Union meant strength, and recognition meant the employer's acknowledgement of that strength." Perhaps his most stirring reflections on the labor movement came in a speech he delivered to the AFL-CIO in Springfield, Illinois in 1965. King said, "The two most dynamic movements that reshaped the nation during the past three decades are the labor and civil rights movements. Our combined strength is potentially enormous. We have not used a fraction of it for our own good or for the need of society as a whole. If we make the war on poverty a total war, if we seek higher standards for all workers for an enriched life, we have the ability to accomplish it, and our nation has the ability to provide it. If our two movements unite their social pioneering initiative, 30 years from now, people will look back on this day and honor those who had the vision to see the full possibilities of modern society and the courage to fight for their realization. On that day, the brotherhood of man, undergirded by economic security, will be a thrilling and creative reality."
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In many small rural settlements in South Africa, residents live in metal shacks with no connections to the regional electricity grid. But now, in one of these settlements, lights are shining.
Each shack operates on a solar panel and a battery.
Lilia Abram is the president of Peer Consultants, an environmental engineering consulting firm, and its sister company, Peer Africa. For decades, she's worked to bring energy-efficient housing to post-apartheid South Africa. Abram says that as part of a project in Kites Municipality in Northern Cape Province, Pure Africa has helped equip more than 500 homes with independent electrical systems.
The solar panel on the roof and the battery is enough to operate inside lights, outdoor lights, a refrigerator, color TV, sewing machine.
Now children can read and study in the evenings by lamplight, and outdoor areas are well lit, which helps to improve safety. So Abram says that the benefits of renewable energy technologies go far beyond the climate.
It's about using science and technology to transform the lives of people.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Tired. Ooh, I am the wife of a black man, the mother of a young black man, and the daughter and sister of a black man. And I'm tired of the injustice going on. Tired worrying when my son lay coming home. Oh, wondering what's going on.
Black Lives Matter by, now who sings this? Black Lives Matter.
This is Lanasa.
Lanasa. This is Rethink the Week, the Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We have in studio with us Rick Newman, former state representative, current lobbyist. We have in studio with us Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University civic scholar and presidential scholar. And I'm praying this is who called in. Dave Schultz is a political science professor at Hamline University and also professor at law at the University of Minnesota. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you very much.
Okay, before we get to this, since it is Martin Luther King's birthday, I got an email just before we came back on, and I have to read the quote by MLK. Capitalism does not permit an even flow of economic resources. With this system, a small privileged few are rich beyond conscience, and almost all others are doomed to be poor at some level. That's the way the system works. And since we know that the system will not change the rules, we're going to have to change the system. This is the same Martin Luther King who supported a basic universal income, and also the same Martin Luther King who basically embraced the idea of democratic socialism. So, Andrew Yang and Bernie Sanders, you're channeling Martin Luther King. All right, since Dave, you are the you're sort of new to the conversation, but not new to this point that we're going to be moving into, and that is impeachment. Impeachment begins in the United States Senate tomorrow. We have now figured out who Donald Trump has lined up for his attorneys and who's going to represent them. So for some reason, Weinstein keeps coming up in my head, but we'll have to explain that later. So let's talk a little bit about, Dave, what we are to expect with this impeachment. Do you think that they are going to actually get witnesses, or is Mitch McConnell going to let two or three of the U.S. senators vote to ask for witnesses, but they won't get the requisite four, so he's covered their proverbial butts, so they get to say, see, I asked, and then they're going to be able to say, but I wasn't able to deliver. So as you're reading the political tea leaves, what are you seeing as we move into this impeachment trial?
You'll get Susan Collins, who will call for witnesses, maybe Lisa Murkowski, maybe one other person, or as a Republican, it goes 50-50, and then guess who gets to break the tie? Mike Pence. So I think you see on the witnesses, that's about it, but there's not going to be enough to actually allow witnesses to testify, because good God, if witnesses testify, who knows what they're actually going to say. So this will be a show trial and a bunch of show votes that we're going to see eventually.
Wait. Let me just say something, because Mike Pence, I thought Mike Pence was not permitted to vote in this tie situation. I thought in the tie situation, it would go to the judge.
There's no clear answer regarding whether the Chief Justice gets to vote in this matter.
Wouldn't it just die on a tie vote? It would just be defeated on a tie vote.
I think it would be defeated. I think that's what Mitch will do. He will not bring Pence in. He will just say, it's a tie, it's defeated.
In either case, it goes no more than 50 votes. Therefore, you don't have 50% plus one. Therefore, no witnesses. And I still stand by my point, which is that at the end of the day, there'll be a few of them who are in tough re-elections who will, and this will be Susan Collins' classic role, that she'll, at the end of the day, you know, she'll wring her hands, she'll make lots of noise, but she'll fall into the straight party line, but they'll let her cast a meaningless vote to allow for witnesses.
Okay, so Rick, play this out politically. Is this going to have any impact on the presidential campaign? I know that they want – that Mitch McConnell wants it done before the State of the Union. That's his kind of goal. He'll go into midnight if he has to, figuring that nobody will stay awake to watch. And I'm not even sure how much we're going to see. But is this going to have any kind of an impact?
You know, I see it perhaps an ability for Trump to fire up that base, that 35% to 40% base that he's got. I don't think, you know, he's going to walk around talking about how he was exonerated and witch hunt and all of that sort of stuff. But I don't think it's going to bring it's going to increase that base in any way. They may be louder. They may be noisier. At the end of the day, no, my guess is it doesn't have much of an impact on the presidential election. I think it will have an impact on certain Senate elections. And I think what Dave just said is, you know, point well taken. Susan Collins is a person I think you've got to look at. She is that person who holds everybody up at dinner, looking over the menu for 25 minutes, and then orders the same thing every single time.
Yeah.
And you know, the people of Maine are starting to figure out about that.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. So I'm looking at an article at Vice.com, Dean Spiliotis, and I'm wondering that, you know, Donald Trump has such disdain for this impeachment hearing. You know, he thinks he made the perfect call. There was something he didn't do wrong. That I even think in the stage that he set with the people he brought in to represent him, the attorneys he brought in, were also kind of a flip the bird at the impeachment hearing. Because the title of the article at Vice.com, Media Reports, Trump Hires Old Wise Men Unconnected to Sexual Abuse Scandals for Impeachment Team. Is there anything Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz have done in recent years that would cast doubt on the soundness of their judgment? I almost think that he chose those two because we would be talking about Weinstein. We would be talking about sort of who they are as opposed to the impeachment
hearing.
Epstein. They're all beginning to sound the same to me. Yeah. What can I tell you? One abuser after another abuser. Or they all have Steen at the end. But I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, oh, my God, he really does do everything from a theatrical perspective. And it's done for performance, but it's not done for integrity. It's not done for respect. It's not done because this is supposed to be a trial. For him, it's a joke. I don't know, Dean.
Well, he's certainly bothered by it. I think he's heading to Davos. He's going to attempt to ignore it, which we'll see how that goes. It's not surprising to me that he picked individuals who have defended him vocally on television, particularly Fox News. I think he likes that Alan Dershowitz describes himself as a liberal Democrat. Certainly, they both Starr and Starr has his own baggage from his time as a university administrator, and Dershowitz as well. Pam Biondi is in the mix also, been a defender of his.
From Florida.
Yeah. But the most interesting thing is for virtually anything that Starr or Dershowitz might say as defenders of Trump, you can basically find them saying the direct opposite during the Clinton impeachment. Right. It just really depends on which side of the debate you're on. So I think this was predictable. I think they're releasing their first brief today or right around now, I believe.
Yeah. Right.
I'll be interested to see how they respond to the prosecutorial document.
Well, I think the first thing
released.
They filed was about 6 pages long, so it obviously it was the primer.
Yeah, there's some additional pleading, I believe,
right.
That is due.
Yeah, if I can throw in here,
yeah,
David Schultz. Yeah, what they filed already was, you know, again, this is not a criminal proceeding, but we're sort of going through the motions as if it is. Mm-hmm. And what they filed was the answer. The answer was the response to the papers that the Democrats had filed. And an answer is supposed to be what? An answer that basically refutes the charges. And what I thought was fascinating in looking at it, besides saying, you know, they refute everything that the Democrats say, well, do you refute the fact that you made a phone call? Do you refute the fact that you're president of the United States? I mean, it was badly drafted, but again, speaking like a law professor, in which I'm sometimes forced to do so, that if this were a criminal proceeding and the 6-page answer that they gave was an answer that had been filed in a regular criminal proceeding, it would be insufficient to respond to the charges that are there. And so the fact that 6 pages pretty much told us everything, it said what? we treat this whole thing as a joke. Yeah, we're just going to attack the integrity of the process. And what? At the end of the day, they're going to get away with it. Why? From an impeachment point of view, a trial point of view. Because why? 5347, you need two-thirds to convict. Right. They don't have to worry about it.
So Rick, the one thing I just thought was interesting is that David said if this was a response in a criminal proceeding, this would not fly, all right? But the problem is high crimes and misdemeanors does not require a crime. So, you know, we use the word criminal proceeding at our convenience, but yet at the same time, when, you know, Alan Dershowitz said there was no crime committed, he's absolutely right, but high crimes and misdemeanors does not require a quote-unquote crime.
Well, it doesn't, but I would argue he's not right because the General Accounting Office has recently said there was a crime committed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so so now we have a government agency has said, yes, there was a crime committed, but, you know, this is a political event. This isn't a criminal proceeding, we know that. So what Trump has done, whether it's talk about Epstein, Weinstein, or Trumpstein, you know what Trump has done is he has made it a joke and done so for a very calculated purpose. You've got a president of the United States who one of his lawyers is argued over the years, over decades, that we ought to lower the age of consent in for sex.
Yeah.
I mean, Alan Dershowitz actually wrote an op-ed saying it should be lowered to 15. He's recently said it should be universally no higher than 16. And now, it was only a massage. We all know that, Alan. But, you know, I think he's got a reason for wanting to say that. But the fact that the president is saying, this guy's going to be my lawyer in this impeachment, and he is saying that this is a joke. And his the thing about it is he wins in that regard because his base will go along with him.
I was going to throw one more thing in. Besides the fact that the GAO said there was a crime, the second article of impeachment, obstruction of Congress, as far as I know, that's a crime also. So, Dershowitz is right. You don't need a crime, but guess what?
We've got
at least one, if not two.
Yeah, Ken?
I was just going to say that there's a big difference between these lawyers who Trump hired now and his previous choices. And yes, they are show people. They put on a good show. They're TV people. But Alan Dershowitz is a mighty good lawyer. He knows his way around a courtroom and presenting evidence and marshaling evidence.
But he's only going to be doing the constitutional argument. Remember that. He's only going to be doing that. He's not going to be doing anything evidentiary. He does not get involved.
Right. But my point is that these guys are damn good lawyers, and that's a big difference than Rudy Giuliani getting up there and, you know, mouthing off and saying stupid things.
So before we sort of move on from this conversation, no matter what happens with this impeachment, we know that at the State of the Union, and I'm thinking he is hoping, whether they call witnesses or not, there will be someone called, and it'll be called by Donald Trump. It'll be the Biden. So what is interesting for me is whether they actually show up or whether there are going to be this sort of conga line of witnesses, what you're going to hear from Donald Trump is as if the Bidens were called, as if they were part of this impeachment. So I think that's the interesting thing. I will bet you dollars to donuts that, Rick, during that State of the Union, you will hear more about Joe and Hunter Biden and the kind of corruption, whether they show up or not. So this impeachment hearing is interesting because it gives him a backdrop and a legitimacy to talk about it. Where you normally wouldn't thread it into your State of the Union, but we will have just either had it, it will either be over, or it will be ongoing, and it will be his excuse. Rick?
Yeah, I think you're probably right, and this is all a part of their tactic, that they the deflection. This is Trump's world. He deflects. You know, when I heard Donald Trump Jr. say, Hunter Biden wouldn't have made any money if it wasn't for his famous father. You just, you know, literally, you can't make that stuff up.
That's right.
You know?
I mean, Where's the mirror? Exactly. So, no, but Dean, I do, we were talking about the decision of at the very beginning of the show, David, we were talking about the New York Times making a decision between Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren. And one of the reasons why I think they had decided to make this sort of dual endorsement of Amy Klobuchar is that not only is Biden not necessarily, I think, the strongest candidate. That's my personal opinion. But I do think that the Hunter Biden, Joe Biden problem is a real problem. And it is a distraction for Joe as he runs his campaign, because even people on the Democratic side still feel like it's a dissatisfying answer and that it's something to – and they're exhausted by the fact that we even have to keep explaining this. They want to move on to issues of the presidency. They don't want to be stuck either defending it with their friends at the Dunkin' Donuts or whether they're trying to figure out, why did this even happen? Isn't it obvious it was the appearance of impropriety? And if you couldn't recognize it then, what will you not recognize when you become president?
And on top of that, well, you know, Joe's response has been terrible. It's basically the Donald Trump response. Yeah. I didn't do anything wrong.
Right. Right. Dean, exactly. I didn't do anything wrong.
Well, you know, we talked about this a number of times. And, you know, as we've all suggested, he needs to have a better answer. But he also needs to recognize that it's not going away. No matter what he says, it's not going away. So whether or not he has a better answer to it, maybe that'll help him with voters. You know, Trump will use it in whatever way he sees most effective, even if that means kind of coming up with new stuff to go along with it. And I think your point is well taken, that he will talk as though, you know, the Bidens were part of the impeachment, even if they weren't.
Even if they weren't.
Yeah,
called.
Exactly.
It's unbelievable.
And that's just the reality. And so that's something that he's going to have to contend with. Is it a deal breaker for him as the nominee? Probably not, but it is a complication that he has to figure out how to deal with.
And I hate to break it to you, we have to figure it out. I mean, remember, we have to make a choice.
Well, the party certainly has to figure it out at first,
and then the general voters. Right, especially in the primary.
Yeah.
So I want to move beyond impeachment, because that's going to be sort of the shadow over everything. Mm-hmm. So, Rick, today is Martin Luther King's birthday, but Virginia is in lockdown. They're terrified because of what's happening with the rally in Virginia about the whole issue of guns. And there was an article written, I believe it was in the New York Times, by Paul Waldman. And Paul Waldman wrote an article about a month ago. And the article basically said, if you want to see what it's going to be like after the 2020 election, you better go to Virginia and start watching what's happening. And what we know about Virginia, Rick, is that it used to be a reliably sort of red state. And then in the last couple of years, it has now turned purple, if not blue. And they have a Democratic governor. They've changed their legislature. We saw remarkable things happen, I believe it was in 2017, in the state of Virginia. And one of the things is that elections have consequences. And when you go from a red-controlled state to a blue-controlled state, issues that are not permitted, we know it in New Hampshire, suddenly come to the forefront, and those are issues that relate to guns. And what Paul was suggesting is that you are not going to get finality or stability after the election in 2020. What you're going to get is more chaos. And then we see what's happening today in Virginia. How do we go forward looking at this level of instability and the idea that, you know, there anytime you address the issue of guns, you turn on a domestic terrorist, I think, in so many ways. That's how I feel. Donald Trump has incited it, and now I'm seeing what is potentially violence in Virginia. Rick?
Yeah, and you know what? I honestly don't have the answer. I don't know who does, but you're right that when Trump speaks, he incites it.
He incites it.
And it doesn't take many. That's the trouble with this issue.
Yes.
A very, very, very small number of people can cause a huge amount of harm, and we don't have an answer for it, but we better get one soon.
Well, and David, Donald Trump massages those few. He encourages those few. The tweet that he put out there about gun rights, you know, and this is an assault on the Second Amendment. No, these were elected officials who represent the will of the people. And part of the reason and part of what they ran on was the whole issue of being reasonable about some things that relate to guns. It's not a blank slate. It's an ability to sort of put some parameters on it. And yet what we're seeing happening is not only does it take the few that Rick was saying, but now their echo chamber are the tweets of the President of the United States, David. That's what makes this so frightening, because I can't figure out how to deal with the few when I've got the guy who's the most powerful man maybe on the planet who's basically sort of, you know, fanning the flames of this discontent.
Donald Trump is only a figurehead for something that's been building for a far longer period of time. You know, I saw Waldman's piece and I read it and I said, it's obvious. I mean, I didn't see anything new in that piece.
No.
I mean, did anybody really think that when Donald Trump ends his presidency, that we're going to suddenly, you know, hold hands, sing kumbaya, and all live happily ever after. No. I mean, the roots of the polarization, the roots of the gun controversy, the roots of so many different things go back 30 to 40 years. Perhaps you could even take it back to Barry Goldwater in terms of building it. And so that Trump, again, that's why I say he's just the figurehead. He's flamed it, but guess what? It was already there anyhow. And again, I, you know, the argument that I make is that I see where the end is going to occur. It's going to be in about 10 years. And what's going to happen in about 10 years is that you're going to see a significant generational replacement in the United States.
Yeah.
Basically, a nice way of saying a bunch of people are going to die and are going to be replaced by a couple of new generations that are not quite as enamored by guns and some of these social issues that we're bothered by our generation.
So,
and that's going to form a new consensus. But short of that, I don't really see anything unless, of course, and this is where I think Bernie Sanders is correctly talking, is in the sense of saying that part of the roots of the polarization are what?
Economics.
Yeah.
So, Dean, I hear what he's saying, that, you know, we'll see some resolution to this in 10 years.
Yeah.
What happens during those 10 years? I mean, the level of instability is so frightening. And maybe what David was saying about the economics is that, I don't know, it sounds crazy, but maybe you can economically stabilize them, which will then take some of the venom out, which will make their embrace of their guns and their anger less toxic. I mean, I just feel like you add the gap between rich and poor, you add the changing demographic, you add the fact that for the last 3 years, the mortality rate in the United States has dropped and declined. You add all these things. I mean, it is a toxic brew, and they grab their gun. But how can you take something out of that toxic brew so maybe there's less?
It's hard to change the. I mean, this is really identity based. It's community based.
Yeah.
It's emotional. There certainly is an economic component to it, and over time that may kind of change the nature of the division. But it's not a quick process. And you know, I talked to lots of different people, and sort of people who don't like Trump have sort of varying levels of apocalyptic vision about what happens if he gets reelected. I don't know, A, whether he'll be reelected, and B, what 4 more years would mean in terms of permanent damage to our institutions. Some people think that it's going to be really destructive. Others think the Constitution is resilient. But we don't know. It's a big question mark. And I think it is true that over time, you look at all the data I've seen, there is going to be a big change generationally, but it's still at least 10 years off.
Okay, so there, I'm going to interview a reporter from, I think it was Atlantic Monthly, Rick. And the reporter from the Atlantic Monthly was saying that if a moderate wins, there will be a voter deflation. And what her argument is that the progressives are actually encouraging new voters to come into the process, young people, people of color, Latinos. And that demographic that we're talking about 10 years out, that if you offer a moderate now, some of the potential of that changing demographic will be lost now, and that you have the potential to grab some of that changing demographic now. And that may be, in the long run, more important than just getting a moderate in, is bringing these people in, because maybe the 10 years that David is talking about could be 8 years, could be 6 years, because you've brought more people into the electoral process. And I'm kind of curious, as you look at not only the electability question, are you seeing this about changing the middle, or do you see this about expanding the base?
I see this election as returning to some kind of normalcy. I think people are just really tired. And I think it's going to come down to who they think has the best chance of winning. And I know that the very left of my party thinks that we ought to have a revolution, and that there are those of us who simply say, let's just put the fire out. And I think the people who want to put the fire out are going to prevail, and maybe that will deflate a certain segment of activists who have gotten involved because of Bernie Sanders or others. But my guess is that's where it's going to end up.
So, David, I'm going to let you go real quickly, but I see the idea of return to normalcy. That does work for the moderates, and it does work for the current base. The return to normalcy, what has been normal for people who are 17, 18, 19, and 20, it ain't so normal. And they don't want what they see as normalcy because they see normalcy as basically taking away their opportunity, as aiding and abetting climate change, as not providing them with health care. So for them, in a lot of ways, normalcy is as much of a negative as what we're seeing now. David, real quickly.
Okay, I think you're right, and I think that's why this is an interesting race, even without Trump in it, because what? Yeah. This is the first without election Trump in probably 40 years where what? Baby boomers are not the majority of the population. It is the transition from the baby boomer to the millennial and Gen Z voting base. And you're right. They have very different generational perceptions of what should be normal.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, Dave.
So I'm generational now?
Oh, shut up.
Okay, boomer.
Okay, yeah, exactly. I'm looking at his white hair. It's okay. We have Dean Spiliota, Southern New Hampshire University. We have Rick Newman, a lobbyist and a former state rep. We have David Schultz from Hamline University. And, of course, Ken Barnes and Arnie Arneson. This is Rethink the Week on The Attitude. And we end with, sir?
We end with Glory by Common and John Legend. Hopefully that'll lift us up to feeling like we can move to that new future.
I want that normal, the Glory. Normal. All right, thank you so much. Here we go.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure. The heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us.